going to this morning session your speaker is Venkat Anantharam from UCL Berkeley. He will speak about Steiner's formula and large deviation theory.
Thank you very much, Fuku, and thanks very much to Francois, Jeff, and Gustavo for the invitation to come and share some ideas with you. It's always a pleasure to be back in Austin. I've been here many times. I hope you can hear me. I usually get very loud as I speak, so I may not need the microphone. This talk is a bit unusual for this conference. Most of the talks that I've heard yesterday and also the general theme of this subject is about the use of stochastic geometry in wireless communications. This talk is about the use of wireless communications in stochastic geometry, actually, so it's a bit unusual. It's also unusual in that I guess much of the stochastic geometry that gets used in this field is it's two-dimensional. This is really a high-dimensional stochastic geometry kind of talk. So it's some of the motivations come from information theory, which is a high-dimensional subject. But I think it's worth sharing it with you because even though the contribution in some sense is to stochastic geometry, it's to the use of stochastic geometry for many things of interest to us in wireless communications and also in things like big data and other kinds of high-dimensional areas. So this is actually the work of my graduate student, Varun Jog, who's going to be graduating this summer. Here's the outline of the talk. I'm going to share with you some parallels between geometry and information theory. Many of you might already be aware of some of these. Then just discuss ways that people have of understanding these connections. Then some kind of relatively newish way of trying to understand these connections. And then at that point I'll get into the applied motivations, that is the motivations from wireless communications that really led us to this sequence of ideas. They involve some geometric notions called intrinsic volumes. They're very beautiful ideas. If you haven't seen them before, at least that's something you should take away from the talk. And a version of what's called Steiner's formula in high dimensions, which I believe is new. That's the connection with large deviations theory that was promised in the title. And then end with the discussion. So the original idea somehow involved a mix of geometry and information theory, so I need to say a few things about information theory. So the notion that we need to remember or to sort of just see the definition of is what's called the differential entropy of a random variable. So by random variable I mean a Euclidean space valued random variable X. I'm going to assume that it has a density. So let's say the density is F. So the differential entropy is this quantity. It's the expectation of minus the logarithm of the density of X. A bit of a strange thing to do, but it's very natural for statistics and information theory. So F is the density of the random variable. Somehow you take the expectation of minus the log of the density. So if you write it as an integral, it's minus integral of F of X log F of X dx, which explains why the word entropy shows up. Then the quantity that I want to discuss is what's called the entropy power of X. A very strange looking formula. So N of X is the entropy power of the random variable X. And basically the way to understand this is that it is the variance of a Gaussian, a circularly symmetric Gaussian, which ends up having the same differential entropy as the original random variable X.
What is H?
H is the differential entropy of X. Given X, you have a number called the differential entropy. This actually, you need some regularity conditions. This need not even be defined. I don't want to talk about all that because the plus and infinity and minus infinity parts might not cancel. So, but this is a number which can be either positive or negative, actually, as opposed to Shannon entropy. The Gaussian, circularly symmetric Gaussian with some fixed variance in each direction, has a certain differential entropy. So you compute the variance of the Gaussian that has that differential entropy. And it's called the entropy power, because it's sort of power-type notion. So it's a number that you associate to the random variable. So there's a fantastic theorem due to Shannon, father of communication theory, And in fact, I believe Kolmogorov believes that this was one of Shannon's greatest theorems. It's called Shannon's Entropy, Power, Inequality. And it says the following. So if you have two independent random variables, Euclidean space valued, x and y, and you form their sum, so the usual sum in arithmetic, then the entropy power of the sum of x and y is always larger than the sum of the entropy powers of x and y. This is Shannon's entropy power inequality. And as usual, I mean, Shannon was, of course, he was a great mathematician, but he wasn't terribly rigorous in everything that he did. So he gave a plausibility argument, and it was subsequently proved by Stamm, and there's a proof by Blackman, and now there are many proofs around. So there are proofs that, that make the mathematicians happy. But Shannon was the one who discovered this inequality. Okay, so this is my information theory story. Now, there's also a circle of ideas in geometry. So suppose you've got two subsets of Euclidean space. You can just think of them as convex subsets. I don't want to be too technical. Then there's a concept of what's called the Minkowski sum of these two subsets. So the Minkowski sum is the following. For instance, if you take a rectangle in a square in two-dimensional space and you take a circle, you can add the two sets to create a new set. And this is a new set. And what you're doing is you're basically taking all possible vectors you can get by taking one vector from the first set, another vector from the second set, and forming their usual vector sum. So this is basically set addition, Minkowski sum. So many of you might have seen these already. Now there's an inequality in geometry called the Brun-Minkowski inequality. And it says the following. So if you have two convex sets, A and B, convex bodies, I mean there's some technical assumption, so compact convex sets with non-empty interior, blah blah. Then the volume of the Minkowski sum, the 1 over nth power of it is lower bounded by the sum of the 1 over nth powers of the volumes of the relative of the individual sets. So the 1 over nth power of the volume, of course, is like the radius of a sphere which has that same volume. And so you can sort of see already the similarities with Shannon's entropy power inequality in some sense. Equality holds only if and only if these sets are homothetic, etc. And there are some other equivalent forms. I don't want to say too much about this. So this can be made equivalent to some kind of inequality based on convex addition of the sets and other forms, etc. So you can already see the parallels, right? There are parallels between Shannon's entropy power inequality and the Brun-Minkowski inequality. So the distribution of a random variable corresponds to the notion of a subset. Addition of independent random variables corresponds to the Minkowski sum. Circular balls basically play the role of spherically symmetric Gaussians. And in fact, there are other equivalent forms of the entropy power inequality. For instance, this is a form of the entropy power inequality which was proved by Lieb, and it sort of related to one of the forms of the Brun-Minkowski inequality that I wrote down earlier. I mean, all this doesn't matter so much to us. I want to get to a sequence of ideas that matters to this community. I'm just sort of setting the stage for that. So here's a picture that illustrates some of these parallels. These are actually very deep and profound parallels. So let's look at the middle one, for instance. So the Gaussian distribution sort of looks like the n-ball in this parallel between information theory and geometry. So here's a schematic of the Gaussian distribution that sort of ball looks like. But there are other kinds of parallels. So if you have a random variable, and you take lots of independent copies of it, and you try to ask yourself, what kinds of samples do you actually see? What kinds of sequences do you see? Well, the kinds of sequences you see end up actually belonging to a rather limited subset because of the law of large numbers, because the sequences have got to exhibit the statistics of the random variable. So any such set is called a typical set associated with the random variable. So as you take a random variable, you take a large number of copies of it, and in this very high dimensional space, you look at the set of sequences that you can get. So if you have a scalar random variable in n-dimensional space, you'll get a certain subset in n-dimensional space, so that's a typical set. And in fact, if you do the math, it turns out that the differential entropy is characterizing the rate of growth of the volume of a typical set. Basically, what happens is that the volume of the set of typical sets grows with dimension, with the number of samples, like e to the n times the differential entropy. So that's also a connection between differential entropy and volume, if you like. The other deep parallel is between the subject of channel coding theory, which is central to all of our hearts, even though we might perhaps work in networking. Underlying the physical layer, there's channel coding happening all the time. Channel coding is a problem of packing noise balls inside an available ball of sequences, because you want to put a bunch of code words so that the noise balls are more or less disjoint. So channel coding is really a problem of sphere packing in geometry. In fact, it's a precise parallel. It's what some people call it information theoretic sphere packing. And lots of ideas in sphere packing theory have been moved to channel coding theory, famously by Levenstein, for instance, in the Russian school. So these are some parallels. Now, some of these parallels are understood. So the next thing I want to do is to just give you, this is not really that important for me to say, but given that I'm in Austin, I wanted to say this. And there is an understanding of how to sort of go between the entropy power inequality and the Brun-Minkowski inequality. And it goes through a whole circle of ideas in Fourier analysis. And it's connected with something called Young's inequality. I don't know how many of you have seen this, but it's certainly worth knowing, at least in terms of having it in your arsenal. So all engineers know that the Fourier transform maps L2 into L2. It may not be that commonly known that it also maps LP into LP prime, where P prime is the Holder conjugate of P. So 1 over P plus 1 over P prime equals 1. So there's Young's inequality. The original Young's inequality actually gives you an estimate on the norm of this mapping. So you consider all functions in LP, consider their Fourier transforms, and try to see how you can relate the P prime norm of the Fourier transform to the P norm of F, of the original function. So it turns out that the sharp constant for this, the best possible constant for this, was discovered by William Beckner, who's right here in Austin. He was the chairman of the mathematics department, might still be, I don't know. It's a very famous piece of work in analysis, which won something called the Salem Prize, which is probably the most profound prize of the American Mathematical Society in analysis. So he characterized the sharp constant for the Fourier transform from LP to LP prime. This is what it turns out to be. And this basically leads to something called Young's inequality. Young's inequality is, there's a huge mess here. We don't need to worry about it too much. But it turns out that if you have two functions, F and G, you can estimate the Rth norm of the convolution of F and G in terms of the Pth norm and the Qth norm of F and G, where P, Q, and R are related through these constants. And in fact, it works this way if P, Q, and R are bigger than 1. It works the other way if P, Q, and R are less than or equal to 1. I'm assuming that they are positive. In fact, you can define LP norms also for P negative and P equal to 0 and so on. But let's not worry about all that. And these are the only cases that arise if P, Q, and R are related like this. So this whole thing is called Young's inequality. And what's interesting is that you can actually derive both the Brun-Minkowski inequality and the entropy power inequality as limiting cases of this inequality. I just wanted to say this because I'm in Austin and, you know, William Beckner is from Austin. So the second half is actually called the reverse Young's inequality. So I'll just skip over the next couple of slides. So you don't need to read all this. So this sequence basically tells you that you can define something called the Renyi entropy associated random variable. This is some P norm version of the entropy. So just be the log is basically like the degeneration of the P norms as P goes towards 1. And so there's something called the Renyi entropy. You can define a Renyi entropy power, and you can work through Young's inequality and take the limit to get the entropy power inequality. The second sequence of slides tells you that you can take the limit as R goes to 0 in Young's inequality. You get another famous inequality called the Prikopa-Leindler inequality, which is associated with log concavity in some interesting sense. And when you take the limit of that, you end up getting Brun-Minkowski inequality. So this is kind of understood. This is a long sequence of results. And there's a survey by Gardner, which actually explains all this, which tells you how to go between those two things. So, of course, you're probably all wondering why I'm telling you all this stuff, right? What's the point of all this? What does it have to do with stochastic geometry, wireless communication, and all that? So I'm going to get to that shortly. So before doing that, I want to say a couple of slides on the mathematical view of what I'm going to say, and then I'll get into why we did it and why you might want to care about it to some extent. So this is sort of an analytic connection between the entropy power inequality and the Brun-Minkowski inequality, but there's also a kind of pathwise connection, what you might call a pathwise connection. I'm sure that people think about it in these terms already, so there's nothing particularly new about it in thinking about things like this, but basically a sequence of random variables is in some sense analogous to a growing family of convex sets. That's really the parallel that you have to keep in mind. One way to understand that is through this notion of typical sets, right? If you have a sequence of iid random variables, you get the set where all the sequences lie. That defines some kind of set. Of course, it need not be convex, but it's a set in n-dimensional space, and n being the number of samples. And as n increases, you get the sets in bigger and bigger spaces. So this is really some kind of pathwise parallel between probability theory or sequences of probability, stochastic processes, and sequences of convex sets. So let's consider a sequence of convex sets. So in each dimension n, we have a convex set k sub n. There are many such examples. So the next slide shows some pictures. So for instance, people consider power constraints in physical layer communications. Power constraints correspond to the balls. So if the power is constrained is P, then in n dimensions, the total energy available is n times P. That corresponds to a radius which is square root of n times P. So you look at the ball of that radius. So in coding, of course, at least in the original viewpoints of Shannon, you have coding over blocks, so the dimension gets bigger and bigger. So what you're getting really is a sequence of sets, namely the sequence of the spheres. Another popular constraint that people study because it's very important, as Jeff pointed out in one of the talks yesterday, is the peak power constraint. And the peak power constraint basically corresponds to cubes. So this is another sequence of convex sets. And then, as I said earlier, there is the sequence of typical sets associated to a random variable. So if you have a random variable with density x, I'm thinking of a scalar-valued variable. I take n iid copies of it. One way to define the typical set is the set of sequences for which the associated density, I should really be writing an F here, is pinned down in this range. And that set is a sequence of sets, a sequence of sets, one in each dimension. So this is a parallel that I want to explore. And now let me talk about the original motivation for us. I don't consider myself a mathematician despite all this. I'm in an electrical engineering department, and the problems that motivate me often, typically I would say, actually come from the application domain, even though I prefer to work on more mathematical end of things. So the problem that we're interested in is energy harvesting. Energy harvesting is considered one of the key sort of concepts that's going to underpin 5G and the Internet of Things and so on, although it's perhaps not the most important part of that story. But we are interested in it. There's been quite a lot of work in the energy harvesting area, and this is what actually led us to this sequence of ideas. So first of all, let me just tell you the math of what we do. The energy harvesting framework, when we model it the way we decided to do it, leads to a certain sequence of convex sets in higher and higher dimensional space when you want to analyze it from the physical layer point of view. That's really what we're doing. And the sequence of convex sets that you get is something that we call the sigma rho power constraints. Actually, the reason for this terminology is also interesting. Sigma rho, people who live in networking and have been around as long as I have will remember the work of René Cruz, who was a student of Bruce Hayek, unfortunately passed away a few years back. And during his PhD thesis, he developed this notion of sigma rho constraints. It's basically some kind of fluid model-based way of doing sort of scheduling analysis in networks and so on and so forth. And this is exactly the same kind of story, except it's relevant to a physical layer scenario where you have power constraints, where you have sort of energy harvesting taking place. So the energy harvesting scenario, the kind of picture I'm going to show many times, is that we look at is something like this. Many people are studying this kind of scenario. It's a physical layer story, so again, that's another reason perhaps some of you might not be that interested. But in any case, it belongs to the general 5G Internet of Things kind of space. So if you think of a point-to-point link, you have an encoder and a decoder. Encoder is at the transmitter, this is at the receiver. And typically you have some message you want to send, so you encode it through some sequence of X's. So if you're using block length N, you'd be sending X1 through XN, the code word X1 through XN. Now, normally in the model you will have some constraint on the ability of the transmitter to send out these sequences. So it might be a peak power constraint or a average power constraint typically. But in an energy harvesting scenario, the viewpoint is that the energy is not available somehow. All you have available is energy in some battery, which stores energy, and then you have energy coming in from the outside world in real time. So there are many, actually, it's very fascinating to see what's happening at the level of physics. So people have many ways of trying to generate energy. The most obvious one is, of course, solar panels. But there are also ways of trying to generate energy from mechanical motion. In fact, there are ideas where people are just walking in the corridor in the building, and you have devices that are able to extract energy from the movement of the people in order to power lights inside the building and so on. There are also ideas that come from biology, where you have some notion of a seed being planted and somehow biochemical energy being extracted, etc. There are many companies that are sort of trying to develop all these ideas at the physics level, partly because it has not become so prevalent, so established at the physics level. It's not even being considered very important for the Internet of Things, but it is part of the general vision. So the idea is that the energy is being generated as time progresses, and you can use the energy either to transmit or to store it in the battery, and the battery has typically got some finite capacity. And then the rest of the model is typically the way usual physical layer models look. So you send the code word, it gets corrupted, maybe with an additive noise framework. Here I've even assumed it's additive white Gaussian noise. The receiver gets the corrupted sequence and wants to decode the message. So this is a kind of framework. And it turns out that the energy harvesting constraint leads to something called a sigma rho power constraint, at least in the basic situation, where the energy harvested per unit time is deterministic. There are already many papers out there in the literature which go beyond that and have stochastic models for the energy harvesting, and the battery is of some fixed size. I'm going to say a lot more about these slides, slow down the pace a little bit and spell this out, because that's central to what I want to convey. But already you can sort of see what the constraints are going to look like. Essentially what ends up happening is that if you're sending a sequence x1 through xn, then over any stretch of time from k to l, the total energy that you can use, namely the sum of the squares of xi, right? So I is going from k plus 1 to l, k is less than l. The total energy that you send over that period of time has to be bounded by the amount of energy that you get from the outside world, which is l minus k times rho, plus the best possible scenario could have been the battery is full. So this is just a bunch of sort of linear constraints, one for each stretch of time, and defines the kind of polytope in n-dimensional space. So the viewpoint I want to have is that for each n you have such a polytope, and you have the sequence of polytopes. And we want to study the coding problem for this sequence of polytopes. So you can kind of see the connection with the earlier sort of weird-looking stuff. So here are some pictures that illustrate what people want to do with energy harvesting. So you can have solar, thermal, electromagnetic energy. In fact, there's also people studying wireless power transfer. You can actually send energy through the wireless. And there are companies that are trying to, popularize that. You know, N-Ocean, there are some alliances and so on, the Zigbee Alliance, etc. So this is basically the kind of vision. So you can use energy harvesting for setting up networks, ad hoc networks, or, hierarchical networks of various sorts. And the energy harvesting model I already described. So, of course, you typically also want to have a notion of unpredictability for the energy. What we studied here is just a deterministic energy harvesting per unit time, presence of a battery, etc. So, the first question, if you're an information theorist, is, okay, here is this new channel model. What is my ability to send information through this channel, right? So, of course, everybody knows that this is just a starting point, right? Because unless you do things in some finite block and you design codes and all that, nothing is actually going to happen in the real world. But the first question you want to ask is, what is the Shannon capacity of such a channel? At least to get some idea of what is possible before you start trying to figure out what you actually can do in practice. So that's the question we decided to ask ourselves. What is the channel capacity of a sigma rho energy constrained additive white Gaussian noise channel? What does capacity mean? Basically what ends up happening is that if you have a block of length n, intuitively the volume grows like an exponentially in n. We already discussed that many times. You can just see that from the cube or the sphere or whatever. The problem of communication is to fit a bunch of noise balls. Each noise ball has got a volume which is also a power of n, but it's a smaller radius. So you take the ratio of these two things, you'll get something growing with n. So the logarithm of that is what people call the capacity. Largest number of sort of code words you can fit in n dimensions. And the question is, what is that, right? So Shannon solved this for the case of spherical power constraints, and it has been solved for other constraints also over the course of the years in information theory. So this is the question we ask. So for instance, for the the peak power constraint, there's a famous paper going back, I think, I forget where, actually, 50s or 60s, by Smith, which finds the capacity for the peak power constraint. The peak power constraint is basically like an energy harvesting system, except that there is no battery. Because in a peak power constraint, you have a fixed amount of energy that you can use at each time. So it's exactly in our sigma rho model, with sigma equal to zero. And for that, it has already been worked out by Smith. And it turns out that this is a famous result in information theory. Here it turns out that the Shannon capacity, that is the largest rate at which you can communicate in a peak power constraint channel, additive white Gaussian noise channel, is given by the formula that you would expect. Once you've seen enough information theory, all formulas look the same. So it's a mutual information between some random variable X and another random variable Y, where X actually is just a real-valued random variable whose density is supported between minus square root of rho and plus square root of rho. And Y is the sum of X and a single sample of a Gaussian with variance n. All these are scalar variables. This expression is what's called the mutual information. It is the differential entropy of Y minus what is called the conditional differential entropy of Y given X, which in this case anyway is the differential entropy of a Gaussian. So this is just a difference between differential entropies. You try to maximize that quantity over all possible input densities which are supported on the range defined by the constraint. And it's known, for instance, that the optimizing distribution is discrete, which is kind of interesting. And the way this social philosophy or psychology works, once you prove a result like this, it tells people how to build codes, and the codes are discrete and so on, and then you can implement these codes, etc. So there's an old result. There's a sigma rho kind of result, but with sigma equal to zero. The traditional, another extreme you might consider is when sigma equal to infinity. So you have an infinite amount of battery. So there, of course, you have to be careful, because if you have an infinite battery which starts out being full, then there's nothing to do, right? You have all the energy in the world. So you imagine that the energy is, battery starts out empty. And here there's a result due to Omur Ozel, who is currently doing a postdoc with me. Senur Ulukush, who was his advisor, she's at the University of Maryland. Here they show that the capacity, in fact, is exactly the Shannon capacity. Shannon capacity for power constraints, that is spherical power constraints, is this formula, where P is the available. So spherical power constraint means that the sum of squares of the code words of xi squared over sum of xi squared over the block length is bounded by n times some p, because you only have a constraint of the energy you send over the entire block. And that turns out to be the same as what you would get in the infinite battery case with the battery started empty. Here p should be what I called rho earlier. And the intuition behind that is very straightforward. It's kind of superficial, actually. So you spend a small part of the block to build up enough energy, and after that you're just communicating it over the block. There's not much to this result from a technical point of view, but it's interesting to see that the cube is at one end and the sphere is at the other. And that's really the picture that I want to convey. And what we are doing with the sigma rho constraints is a bunch of polytopal constraints that are sitting in between this cube and the sphere. That's really the picture. Question?
Just coming back to the last one, so you showed that the optimal input distribution for this bounded power is...
Yeah.
It's also uniform, since that maximizes
No, it's discrete. There's only a finite set of points at which you have to communicate, so it can't be uniform. What's for instance in the low signal noise ratio, it basically sits at the extremes of the, it's like a bang-bang kind of thing, but as you get further out, you get further, it's more points on the inside, etc. There's several papers that I've studied, there's some kind of fixed point equation you have to write down, and the solutions for, some integral equations, solutions for that turn out to be discrete, and there's several papers that I've tried to analyze in detail the structure of that discrete distribution and so on. It's an old result and quite interesting to a lot of people as I can see, right? Yeah, because peak power constraint is certainly something that you want to impose in addition to average power constraints. Okay, so what about sigma rho power constraints? So let me just sort of spell this out a little bit more. So actually, I don't need to do that. I think it's kind of obvious, right? So the total energy over a block is bounded like this. So here's a picture that illustrates what we're saying. So somehow the total amount of energy as it grows has to be bounded by this line. And there's also a battery-centered view. So, I think I want to say this because people who have worked in the René Cruz kind of style of, and also C.S. Chang is someone I should mention, and Francois has worked a lot on this too in the old days, for this sigma rho kind of constraints, will recognize that one of the beauties of this class of constraints is that it allows you to actually think in Markov decision theory terms, because the state of the battery actually works as a complete summary of everything that has happened in the past. So you have this kind of state in the dynamical system system sense which progresses in time. And this equation actually tells you how to think about that, because the total amount of energy you have in the battery at time k plus 1 is the minimum of the battery capacity and this quantity. So the previous time you had this much energy in the battery, this much energy came in, this is what you used up. So the minimum of these, if this stuff was bigger than sigma, you couldn't store it. You can only store sigma. Otherwise, you'd be storing this stuff, right? So the sigma k is acting like a kind of state. So you can actually do dynamic programming and all the fancy stuff that you like to do with traditional stochastic models in this discrete context. This is why it's so interesting. So I think it's important to say this. So both views are equivalent. Basically, the amount of energy left in the battery is going to be, let's say you start with the battery full, so it's a minimum of sigma, then sigma plus rho minus xk squared, blah, blah, blah. And anybody who's done even the smallest amount of queuing theory recognizes Lindley equations and all this sort of stuff floating around here. So it really fits into a stream of thinking that we are all familiar with. And you could do lots of things with this. It's surprising that people have not, because there are lots of beautiful results out there which study, for instance, structural properties of optimal strategies and various kinds of scheduling problems, threshold rules and all these switching rules and so on and so forth. And all that could in principle be worked out for these kinds of problems, and people are too busy doing more interesting things, perhaps, I don't know. But this is so sigma rho constraints define a certain subset of Euclidean space consisting of all those sequences which satisfy these constraints, namely that over any stretch of time k to l, xk plus 1 squared plus so on, xl squared is bounded above by sigma plus rho times l minus k. So that defines some kind of polytope. And capacity we are going to study in the usual Shannon theory sense. We have a certain number of messages we'd like to send, which grows exponentially with the block length. Each message is encoded as a sequence of length n, additive white Gaussian noise for us, and a decoder tries to decode. We want the average probability of error to go to zero. Capacity is the supremum of the achievable rates, and we can prove this. It's not hard to prove, but you need to prove a result like this to start with, which is some kind of information stability for this channel. So the capacity formula is the one you expect, in that if you take the largest mutual information you can get over the block and you normalize it appropriately, that limit exists. Okay? Actually, you need to prove this for any sequence of channels. It's called information stability of the channels. And we proved that. It's not hard to do. It's based on some subadditivity. So the question we asked ourselves was, how do we actually find this quantity? So the thing is, we have not found this quantity. Okay? It's hard to find. But we have good upper and lower bounds. And the bounds actually match to several derivatives, both at low signal-to-noise ratio and at the high signal-to-noise ratio. So that's a subject for another kind of talk. It's a physical layer talk. But I want to convey the stochastic geometry ideas that went into the proof of this. So this has led to a class of ideas in stochastic geometry, and that's really the center for what I want to convey, and I better get to it soon if I want to get to that point. Okay. So I'm getting now into the main thing I want to convey. So all this stuff having to do with channel coding, etc., is somehow related to growth rates of volumes. So you have some available growth rate of volume. For instance, in the spherical case, it's the volume defined by the power constraint. You have the volume that is eaten up by the noise balls, and you want to see how many noise balls you can fit inside this bigger ball. So you want to understand the growth rate of volume. So for instance, if you're looking at typical sets, the growth rate of volume is defined by the differential entropy, and that's here. And it turns out you can get capacity lower bounds using just the available volume. Because, for instance, you can say, well, here is this available volume, and I start eating up bits of volume. So if I eat up too much of the available volume itself, I can't really, there's not enough space around. So it tells me that, the capacity cannot be bigger than something. So that I can get lower bounds. The problem with pinning down the capacity is the following problem. It's very easy to visualize geometrically. Even for the sphere, right, if I start putting code words inside the sphere, some of the centers of the code words can get very close to the boundary. In fact, most of them will be, because all the volume is in the boundary. But the ones that are near the boundary will have the noise balls going out of the sphere. So what really matters is not the volume of the sphere itself, but the volume of the Minkowski sum of the sphere and a noise ball. Because the noise ball is allowed to go outside the sphere. So pinning that down is a big problem, because how does that behave? And what we discovered, because we were dealing with these strange constraints, the sphere and the cube are actually very well understood sets, so it's not necessary to think in some kind of deeper geometric terms, is that somehow the question is, we ask ourselves, is volume the only thing that matters? It turns out that if you think a little bit, it turns out it's not. So let's maybe, since... let me just cut to the chase. And okay, let's look at the additive white Gaussian noise case. So let's consider the case where we have a spherical constraint, and we are looking at noise balls which have got very small power. So the balls that are going inside, which you want to make disjoint or roughly disjoint, they're very, very small. And we want to ask, what does the capacity behave like as the noise power goes to zero? So it's a packing picture, so you get this vague idea that you'd want to look at the volume of the sphere divided by the volume of the noise ball, and you take the logarithm of that divided by n. So that suggests that you will get a formula like this, and this is indeed the correct formula in the Shannon case. So the V is defined by the power constraint, and this is the correct formula. But if you think about this intuition a bit, this intuition actually is flawed. And the way to understand why it's flawed from an information theory point of view is to consider this strange region. For instance, one way to understand it is to consider the following strange region. So I'm going to have, let's do the peak power constraint. So I'm going to have the peak power constraint on the first n minus 1 coordinates, but on the nth coordinate, I'm going to have some incredibly stringent constraint. 2 minutes. Wow. 2 minutes? Doesn't look like it.
7 minutes.
Huh? Yeah, it's more like 7 minutes. Okay, yeah. So I'll have to eat into the question time. So it's a noise ball. Okay. I think I have, in the average. Thank you. I'm going to need more than that. Maybe 5 minutes, yeah. So basically the way to understand that is to imagine this picture. So if you have n minus 1 dimensional coordinates, which are all peak power constraints, but you have an incredibly stringent constraint on the last coordinate, then it changes the volume dramatically because this coordinate reduces the volume like crazy, but it doesn't change your ability to code, right? Because you don't have to use the last coordinate. You still have so much space available in the first n minus 1 coordinates. So volume is not the only thing that matters. What matters is the shape of the region. So you need to understand shape. So now I get to intrinsic volumes. So in stochastic geometry, the first problem that you see, I think, when you play around in stochastic geometry is Buffon's needle problem. So the problem is that you have a needle of some fixed length L, and you're throwing it on a bunch of parallel lines. The lines are separated by some distance d. You want to ask yourself, what is the probability that the needle intersects one of the lines? You can do the calculation, and the answer turns out to be 2L over pi d. So you just think of the center of the needle as being uniformly distributed on an interval of this length, and the angle as being uniformly distributed over the circle, and you can do the calculation, turns out to be this. On the other hand, you can also study the following problem, which is the Buffon's noodle problem. Some of you might have seen this. I don't think it's unique to us. So Buffon's noodle problem is the following problem. So once again, you have a system of parallel lines, and you throw a noodle on it, and you ask, what is the probability that the noodle hits a line? Okay. So the amazing thing is that this answer also is 2L over pi d, where L is the length of the noodle. And the reason for this is that you sort of think of the noodle as being comprised of a small bunch of infinitesimal lines. And this thing is just additive, right? So you look at the mean number of intersections, actually, I should say. So then basically the answer turns out to be this. So this is where the notion of intrinsic volumes comes in, and in the interest of time, I'll just go through this somewhat quickly. So the notion of intrinsic volume of a convex body is basically the generalization of the Buffon's noodle idea. So you think about a system of parallel subspaces, you throw the, of dimension n minus k, you throw the body on the system of parallel subspaces, and you ask yourself basically how much intersection you get. And that quantity is the kth intrinsic volume of this body. I find it more convenient actually to think about it. So let me just go to this slide in the interest of time. I find it more convenient to think about it in the following way. So you imagine all the k-dimensional subspaces centered at the origin, and you give them the natural measure on the space of all these subspaces. You take your body and you project it onto one of these subspaces, and you compute the volume of the projection. And you take the expected value of that projection, and that's basically the k-dimensional intrinsic volume. All this up to some normalization. So there's a theorem called Hadwiger's theorem, which tells you the following. You can define what's called a polyconvex set. A polyconvex set is a finite union of convex sets. And you can ask yourself what kinds of functions on polyconvex sets have the following property. This makes the function what's called a valuation. That is, the function evaluated on the union should be the sum of the functions on the individual sets minus the function of the intersection. And you can characterize all the rigid body invariant valuations, and they're basically spanned by n plus 1 such functions. The nth one of these is the volume, the zeroth one is the Euler characteristic, and the things in between are these intrinsic volumes. So this is these intrinsic volumes are a natural generalization of volume in all these different ways. They are known for certain simple sets. So for a cube of side S, these are the intrinsic volumes. For balls, these are the intrinsic volumes. Now, the formula I want to convey to you is something called Steiner's formula. Steiner's formula tells you that there's a connection between intrinsic volumes and the way volume behaves when you add spheres to a set. So if you take any convex set and you add a sphere to it in the appropriate space, then the volume of the Minkowski sum of the set and the sphere, let's say you scale the sphere by some radius r, turns out to be a polynomial in the scaling factor r. So the volume basically behaves like this. So there are powers of r going from 0 to n, and the coefficients turn out to be the intrinsic volumes of the original body you started with, together with some factors which involve the volume of spheres. So this is Steiner's formula. So now here's our contribution. So some properties of intrinsic volume. So they're monotone, which is kind of obvious. If you take the product of two sets, then the intrinsic volumes actually convolve, which is not hard to see, because their sets are living in different subspaces. Orthogonal subspaces. Okay. So, the volume is the growth rate of, the rate of growth of volume is kind of what people have generally been studying in these kinds of questions. So, in order to pin down the shape, we asked ourselves the following question. I don't know if anybody has done this before. What is the rate of growth of intrinsic volumes? This is the question that we asked ourselves. This is really the punchline of the talk in some sense. And you can actually show that if you do these things on the right scale, that is, if you look at the intrinsic volume, not at the as a specific volume, but if you look at the n theta intrinsic volume, where theta is going between 0 and 1. So intrinsic volume, there are n of them for n dimensions. You take a theta, so you look at the half nth intrinsic volume, or the 2/3 nth intrinsic volume. And you look at the growth rate of this quantity. That is the growth rate of the logarithm of the n theta intrinsic volume at time n for a sequence of sets. Then, under conditions, you can show that this limit exists. And for zero, for if the set is connected, for theta equal to 0, you get 0. For theta equals 1, you get the volume. So for the sphere, for instance, where things are known, this quantity turns out to have this limit. This is the binary entropy of theta. For the cube, it turns out to have this limit. This is the binary entropy of theta. And we would wanted to basically try to figure out what the intrinsic volumes are of this set S n sigma rho. And our bounds on capacity are based on that. So the results are something like this. I'll go through them very quickly. So whenever you have a family of sets which are, we should really call the super multiplicative. So a set in m dimensions, a set in n dimensions with the property that the product of the sets is contained inside the corresponding set in m plus n dimensions. So we have this family of convex sets and they have this super multiplicative property. Then it turns out that the intrinsic volumes of these sets will be super convolutive because the product of sets leads to convolution of the intrinsic volume sequences. So you'll get a super convolutive set sequence of intrinsic volumes. So we are able to prove the following theorem. This is precisely an analog of large deviations theory. It is in fact proved using the Gartner-Ellis theorem. It says that if you look at the log moment generating functions associated to the intrinsic volumes, and then for a sequence of superconvolutive sequence of convex sets in higher and higher dimensions, these things end up having a large deviations type limit, which is precisely the convex conjugate dual of the log moment generating functions of the intrinsic volume sequences. Now, in the last remaining minute or so, let me just illustrate that there are some issues that we needed to resolve. This convergence is in the large deviation sense, but what we really wanted was a pointwise convergence result. And in principle, that might not hold because if you have a large deviations convergence. So there are lots of things known about intrinsic volumes. There's one result called the Alexandro-Fenchel inequality, which tells you that the logarithm of the intrinsic volume for any convex set is actually a log-concave sequence. And it turns out that if you have the superconvolutiveness plus the log concavity, then you can convert the large deviations convergence result into a pointwise convergence result. So this is one difficulty that we were able to resolve using the Alexandro-Fenchel inequality. Second difficulty that you run into is that even though you have the limit might in principle exhibit jumps at 0 and 1. So you have to you want continuity from 0 to 1 in order to basically pin down this generalization of volume and differential entropy. And we have to figure out how to deal with these jumps. So the jumps can be a problem because somehow you're really dealing with the convolution of the volume of the ball. And to deal with that, what you do is, let me just cut to the chase here. So to deal with that, In this case anyway, in the case of these S sigma rho constraints, you not only have superconvolutiveness, approximate superconvolutiveness, you also have a kind of subconvolutiveness, because the constraint on M plus N is contained inside the product of the constraint in M and the constraint in N, because this one corresponds to the battery becoming full. The superconvolutivity you get through some approximate scheme, actually, only approximately superconvolutive. So that deals with this sequence. And there's a whole different stream of just dealing with typical sets. Let me just end with the result there. So when you're dealing with just a sequence of just a random variable of some density, in the case of log concave densities, these typicality sets end up being convex sets, and we are able to carry this program through for that. There are several details which I won't discuss, but the upshot of it is the following. So this is the last slide I'll leave you with. So when you have a log concave density, we are able to carry through this entire program, show the existence of the limit, show that there are no jumps, and we get a function which generalizes the differential entropy. So there is a function associated with any random variable which is log concave at the moment for us, which interpolates between 0 and the differential entropy and is parameterized by theta between 0 and 1. And this is basically the growth rate of the theta nth intrinsic volume of the typical set of the random variable. So it's a sort of a contribution to information theory in that sense. So all this is stochastic geometry-like and motivated by the wireless scenario. So I thought I'd just give a new twist to what the theme of the conference was about. And that's pretty much all I have to say. These are the two papers where things are going to appear. Thank you.
What about the case where the this harvesting conditions would involve a stochastic process?
Yeah, so I mean, there's several results of Senur that give you some estimates there, and we are thinking about it. Yeah, so I think that the sets that you would get would be quite different, and you might want to prove. The fact is that the limit that we proved, the last deviation result we proved, is completely general, so it would apply to such scenarios. But if you wanted to deal with the jumps, etc., then you have to do a case by case analysis. So we haven't thought about all that. But I really think the higher order bit somehow is just that, you know, this notion of dealing with the shape of these volumes through intrinsic volumes, not necessarily coming from the energy harvesting scenario, as for instance in typical sets, etc. So what we'd like actually is to go beyond the log concavity assumption and to define these notions for arbitrary densities. We also have some conjectures which generalize the EPI conjecture. We have a conjectured entropy power inequality for this H theta quantity, and that's what we are currently trying to prove. So.